Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place we go when we need to take complex foundational ideas and, well, turn them into actionable knowledge.
And today we are absolutely wrestling with a giant.
We are. We're talking about one of the biggest names in 20th century developmental psychology, a radical Soviet thinker whose work was so disruptive it continues to reshape education all over the world. Lev Vygotsky.
Indeed. We are diving into his seminal 1934 work, Thought and Language.
Right.
And it's a book that just fundamentally reoriented how we understand the relationship between what's going on in your head, your cognitive structure, and the words you use to express it.
Or even the words you use to organize that thought, you know, silently.
Exactly.
The hook here is, on the surface, really simple. How are your thoughts and your words connected? For centuries, psychology and philosophy, they kind of assumed the connection was either mystical or just purely natural, something innate, biological, like breathing or blinking.
But Vygotsky comes along and argues that this connection isn't natural at all. It is deeply, profoundly cultural.
So our mission today is a custom analysis of this work. We're going to go chapter by chapter, really, to show you, the listener, exactly how Vygotsky built his case.
Yeah, what experimental evidence he used and what his findings meant for our understanding of child development, concept formation, and really the very nature of human consciousness.
Okay, let's set the stage. Because Vygotsky's central idea, I mean, it wasn't just another academic paper.
No, not at all. It was more like a theoretical earthquake.
Yeah.
In the 1920s and 30s, the dominant view saw thinking as this very individual natural process.
Right, something that just resides in the brain.
Exactly. You had behaviorism.
Right.
Stimulus response.
Yeah.
Or you had Piaget focusing on this idea of purely biological maturation.
And both of those see culture as just external information.
That's a crucial distinction. For them, culture was just the content, the stuff being transmitted like facts in a textbook or, you know, life experiences.
But Vygotsky completely inverted this.
He did. He didn't just say culture influences thinking. He argued culture is the force that shapes and structures and mediates our cognitive processes.
So we don't just learn content from our environment.
No, we learn the tools, and language is the master tool that radically restructure how we think. It's not a passenger. It's the vehicle itself. It drives the transformation of our sort of raw biological functions into what he called higher mental functions.
And this focus on cultural mediation leads directly to his most disruptive view, especially for education concerning instruction and development.
Mm.
Because the dominant view, the Piagetian view, was that a child had to reach a certain level of, you know, biological maturity first.
Right. They had to be ready for instruction.
Exactly. Only then could you teach them abstract concepts.
And Vygotsky just famously rejected that lockstep, stage-dependent model. His radical idea was that instruction doesn't just follow development.
It leads it.
Yes. Higher mental functions are the products of constructive teaching and learning. Instruction activates these latent developmental processes that would otherwise just lie dormant. In short, teaching drives development.
And this is where we get his most famous concept, and frankly, the one that's had the biggest impact on actual classrooms. The zone of proximal development, the ZPD.
The ZPD is, well, it's a measure of the child's learning potential, not their existing competence.
Okay, break that down.
It's the distance between what a child can do on their own, what a static IQ test might measure,
yeah,
and what they can achieve when they're working cooperatively with a more competent peer,
cool,
or an adult instructor. It's looking at psychological functions that are just emerging.
So if a test says a child has a mental age of 8, that's just the floor.
That's just the floor. The ZPD defines the ceiling of their potential at that exact moment.
Right.
Think about it like a dynamic assessment. A child is given a puzzle. They struggle. Now, instead of just marking it wrong, the assessor offers these systematic graduated hints. If the child can solve it with the smallest hint possible, that success shows a function that is already developing. It's a function inside the ZPD. The focus isn't just on the product, did they get it right, but on the process.
On the modifiability.
Yes. And this is in direct contrast to models that treat the mind like some fixed thing just waiting for time to do its work. Vygotsky saw the mind as being constructed piece by piece through social interaction.
Okay, so let's unpack this, starting with chapter one, the problem and the approach. Vygotsky begins his book not with an answer, but with a pretty heavy methodological critique of the psychology of his day. He called it atomistic.
His core complaint was that researchers treated psychic processes in isolation, You know, they'd study thought separate from speech, memory separate from attention.
So even if they accepted that consciousness was a unified thing in philosophy,
in practice, they studied its development as if it were just these single functions developing on their own, like separate streams all flowing to the same river.
Which meant they were fundamentally missing the true essence of psychic development.
For Vygotsky, that essence lies in understanding the changing interfunctional relations. How does memory change when it gets linked to language? How does your attention change when it becomes linked to deliberate thought? That interconnected change, that's everything.
So to study that, he had to reject the main method of the time, which he called analysis into elements.
Right, and he used that fantastic analogy, the analysis of water, to explain exactly why this approach was a dead end for studying something like verbal thought.
The famous water analogy. Can we walk through that?
Absolutely. So if you analyze water, which is like the verbal thought we actually observe, into its chemical elements, hydrogen and oxygen.
You learn about them separately.
Right. Hydrogen burns, oxygen sustains combustion. But if you want to know why water extinguishes fire, knowing that its parts do the opposite is no help whatsoever.
You lose the specific emergent properties of the whole, the very properties that make water water.
Precisely. And if you break verbal thought into word and thought and study them separately, you learn nothing about the nature of verbal thought itself.
So if elemental analysis fails because it destroys the thing you're studying, the alternative had to be analysis into units.
Yes. The chosen unit needed to retain all the specific properties of both thought and speech. It had to be the psychological equivalent of an H2O molecule, not separated H&O atoms.
And for Vygotsky, that unit is word meaning.
That's it.
Okay, let's pause on that. Why word meaning? What makes it the perfect meeting ground, the perfect unit?
Because it performs a dual function that fuses the intellectual and communicative processes. First, word meaning is inherently a generalization. It's a verbal act of thought.
Okay.
When you say the word dog, you aren't referring to one specific dog, but to a whole class of objects defined by shared attributes. That is thinking.
And the second part?
Second, meaning is an inalienable part of the word itself. A sound sequence without meaning is just noise, not language. So it belongs equally to conceptual thought and to articulated language.
So by studying how word meaning develops, we're actually studying the development of generalization, which is thought, and the symbolic system, which is language, at the same time.
We are. Word meaning becomes the core unit, linking the intellectual function of speech, you know, abstraction, with its primary social communicative function.
Right.
And Vygotsky really emphasizes that communication isn't just about spreading feelings, like in primitive communication.
He uses the example of a frightened goose, right?
Exactly. One goose panics, the whole flock panics. That's just contagion. That's not communication. Rational, intentional communication needs a mediating symbolic system to intentionally convey a specific thought.
And to do that, you have to generalize.
It's imperative. Vygotsky quotes the anthropologist Edward Sapir on this. Sapir said that our raw experience has to be simplified and generalized before we can even create language.
Why is that?
Because your single, raw, immediate experience is, strictly speaking, incommunicable.
Mm-hmm.
I can't feel exactly what you're feeling right now. So we have to associate language elements with whole groups, delimited classes. This confirms that generalization is, well, it's presupposed by communication, and it's achieved in the course of social communication. Word meaning is the psychological spot where that fusion happens.
So once Vygotsky has his unit of analysis, word meaning, he has to test it against the dominant theory of the time. And that brings us to chapter two, his really robust critique of Jean Piaget.
Vygotsky had deep respect for Piaget's experimental work, but he fundamentally disagreed with how Piaget interpreted his own findings.
So what was Piaget's framework?
Piaget laid out a progression where the child moves from early autism, this state of sort of irrealistic, pleasure-seeking thinking, through egocentrism, and then finally reaches directed thought, which is logical, realistic, and social.
And the cornerstone of that whole theory was the idea that this autistic, irrealistic thinking comes before realistic, logical thought. The child starts off purely subjective.
And Vygotsky just strongly challenged that primacy of autism. He drew on thinkers like Eugen Bleuler, who argued that autistic function is actually a late product in development. It's what appears when logical, realistic thinking fails.
That makes more biological sense.
It does. Think about it. An infant seeks real satisfaction food, warmth, not hallucinations about pleasure. If the reality principle didn't exist from the very beginning, the infant wouldn't survive. Realistic thought, even at a primitive level, has to be primary.
That reframing is huge. But the real central battleground between the two of them was the function and the fate of egocentric speech.
This is the core of the chapter. For Piaget, egocentric speech, that's when a child is talking out loud to themselves while they play, is non-social.
It's just noise.
It's just an overflow, a linguistic leftover from the child's non-social mind. It accompanies what they're doing, but it doesn't serve a purpose.
Yeah.
Piaget thought it was just destined to disappear, to atrophy, around age 7 or 8.
But Vygotsky, through his own observations and experiments, saw something completely different.
Radically different. He argued it was anything but useless noise. He redefined it as speech for oneself.
A tool.
A tool of thought. It serves mental orientation, planning, problem solving. It's a critical stage in the internalization process. And his experimental evidence was fascinating.
What did he find?
He found that egocentric speech didn't happen randomly. It actually peaked when tasks were moderately difficult.
Nothing interesting.
If the task was too easy, the child was silent. If it was impossibly hard, they gave up and were silent. But when the task was just within reach, right, in that Z to Z egocentric speech just erupted as the child used language to organize their behavior, to strategize.
So the speech isn't just accompanying the activity, it's directing the activity.
That's the functional difference. And modern research has confirmed this over and over. Studies show that the presence of task-relevant private speech is highly predictive of better performance on future tasks. It indicates self-regulation.
Which means it doesn't atrophy. It doesn't disappear. It transforms.
It is the crucial genetic link. Vygotsky showed that the older child doesn't stop talking to themselves. They just internalize this self-guiding function. The path is a continuum.
Okay, what's the path?
External speech, which is communication with others, that leads to egocentric speech, which is self-guidance that's still vocalized.
Yeah.
It's transitional. And that leads to inner speech, silent, structured thought.
So what Piaget saw as a developmental dead end, like a linguistic appendix.
Right.
Vygotsky saw as the essential bridge to true, sophisticated inner thought.
And that transition is what defines the development of consciousness itself. I mean, ask an adult to solve a really difficult, novel, problem-like, complex coding or a tough puzzle, and what do?
They often start muttering to themselves.
They revert to that audible, egocentric speech, talking themselves through the steps. That adult behavior is just the functional manifestation of the inner speech that evolved directly from the child's monologue. It's a fundamental shift. Speech moves from being a way to communicate thought to others to a way to organize thought for oneself.
That discussion really sets the stage for exploring the genetic origins of this convergence, which he does in chapters 3 and 4. Vygotsky had to show that thought and speech were, in their earliest forms, functionally separate.
Right, both in phylogeny, the evolution of our species, and in ontogeny, the development of the individual child.
So let's start with phylogeny. What did he find when he looked at our primate relatives?
He found really compelling evidence for independent origins. He looked closely at Wolfgang Köhler's famous studies on chimpanzees, which showed these genuine flashes of nonverbal insight.
Those are the experiments where the chimps are, like stacking boxes or joining sticks to reach bananas.
Exactly. That demonstrated ape intellect, or thought. But Vygotsky noted a critical limitation. Köhler found that this problem solving was highly dependent on the immediate visual presence of the whole situation.
So if the tool and the banana weren't visible at the same time?
The problem became nearly impossible for them to solve. The chimpanzee's intellect was bound to the sensory visual field. It lacked symbolic mediation.
So their thought was concrete, tied to the here and now. What about their language? Their speech?
Köhler concluded that ape language functioned entirely apart from their intellect. Their vocalizations were entirely subjective, just expressing emotion, excitement, rage, affect.
So they never designated objects symbolically?
Never. They might make a sound associated with an action, like walking, but they couldn't use a sound to represent a banana that wasn't right there. The crucial lack, Vygotsky stressed, was the inability to use signs to mediate and generalize.
So pre-human thought was concrete and tool-based, and pre-human speech was purely emotional. Two distinct lines of development.
And Vygotsky showed a parallel in the child's own development, in ontogeny. There's a clear pre-linguistic phase of thought. Carl Buehler called it the chimpanzee age, around 10 to 12 months.
Where kids are exhibiting those same intellectual actions using simple tools, understanding object permanence, but without language yet.
They're solving nonverbal problems. And conversely, there's a pre-intellectual phase of speech babbling, crying, which is purely for emotional release or getting attention, long before those sounds become real symbols.
But these two separate lines are destined to meet.
They are. The convergence happens when speech becomes rational, when it's based on symbolic meaning and generalization, and when thought becomes verbal, structured by words.
And Vygotsky was critical of theories, like from William Stern, who suggested this was like a sudden discovery.
Yeah, the idea that a light bulb just clicks on for the child. Oh, everything has a name.
Which sounds a little too simple, too magical.
It is. Vygotsky saw it as a complex, gradual, functional transformation. The child doesn't just discover that things have names. It requires a relatively high level of conceptual thought and language development just to be capable of making that discovery.
The word itself has to change from just being a peg to being a symbolic tool for abstraction.
Precisely. And that transformation, that functional shift, is what ultimately leads to the final internalized stage of inner speech.
So we come back to that three-stage path.
We do. External to egocentric to inner speech. The transition is the ingrowth stage, where the function turns inward, because its psychological role changes so dramatically. When speech goes from communicating with others to guiding oneself, the external physical act becomes psychologically redundant. It's naturally internalized.
Okay, so we've established word meaning is the unit, and that thought and word eventually converge. But how does the human mind actually form those word meanings, those concepts that define higher thought?
Right. Chapter 5 is dedicated to the stages of concept formation, and this required Vygotsky to invent a completely new experimental method.
Because the old methods weren't working.
No. Traditional methods only tested already formed concepts, usually by asking kids for definitions. That doesn't show you the process, the inner dynamics of how the concept was reached. So Vygotsky and his collaborator Lev Sokurov developed the method of double stimulation.
Double stimulation? That sounds like a way to force abstraction. What was the setup?
It was a fascinating, really elegant method. They used 22 blocks that varied by four attributes, color, shape, height, and size.
Oh.
But the key was that two abstract, non-obvious attributes, like, say, large and tall, were designated by a nonsense word written on the bottom, like egg or M-U-R.
Oh.
The child was shown a sample block, told its nonsense name, and then told to find all the other blocks that fit with this one, assuming they all had the same name.
So the child had to figure out the concept. For example, that egg means tall and large. They had to infer it by testing hypotheses.
Exactly. It forced the subject to engage in the inner dynamics of classification. And it revealed the step-by-step reasoning they used to group the blocks. And Vygotsky sorted these into three major phases.
Okay, let's start with phase one, the most primitive stage.
Phase one is the syncretic heaps. Here, the child just groups objects based on unstable, subjective, often chance impressions. They might group the blocks they picked up first or blocks that are near each other.
There's no real logic to it.
None. Pavel Blonsky called it the incoherent coherence of a child's thinking. They compensate for their lack of objective knowledge by merging diverse elements into one temporary image. It's all driven by subjective perception.
Okay, then phase two seems to be the critical transition where things get a bit more objective.
Phase two is thinking in complexes. Here, objects are united not just by the child's subjective impressions, but by actual concrete bonds between the objects.
They're paying attention to the attributes.
They are. But crucially, these bonds still lack the true abstract logical unity of a concept. He called it a family relationship, not an abstract definition.
What do you mean by a family relationship?
Well, he defined five types of complexes, but the most revealing one is probably the chain complex. That one just beautifully illustrates the non-logical nature of this thinking.
Okay, how does the chain complex work?
Imagine the child is shown a small yellow triangle. They pick the next block because it's also yellow, let's say a large yellow square. Then they pick the third block because it's also a square, a large red square. Then the fourth because it's also a large red circle.
I see. So the chain holds together link by link.
Factually, yes. Each link connects to the one before it. But the end block, the large red circle, has nothing in common with the starting block, the small yellow triangle. There's no central unifying concept. The grouping is concrete and it's always shifting.
So if the chain complex shows these shifting bonds, what about the pseudo-concept? That one sounds like the most treacherous phase.
The pseudo-concept is, well, it's arguably the most important finding in the chapter. Because phenomenologically, to an outside observer, it looks exactly like a true concept.
Meaning the child gets the right answer.
Precisely. If the adult concept is all red small squares, the child, when guided by that word, will correctly group only the red small squares.
Do they have the concept?
Ah. But that's the trick. Psychologically, they don't. If you ask them why they group them, their reasoning is still guided by concrete, visual, associative likeness. Not by the abstract combination of redness and smallness and squareness.
So the product is right, but the process, the thinking behind it, is completely different, a lower-level process.
Exactly. They're using adult language, but thinking complexly. And this is the critical bridge from social language to true thought. Vygotsky realized that the pseudo-concept is often predetermined by the adult linguistic milieu.
The adult splays the word, like, square, and the child builds a concrete complex around it.
Yes, and that complex functionally coincides with the adult concept, which allows for mutual understanding, for communication, even though their underlying thought structures are totally different.
So language acts as a template, forcing the child to behave as if they have the abstract concept, which eventually helps them actually form it.
That's it. And Vygotsky used this insight to reinterpret anthropological data that had been labeled primitive mysticism. He referenced Levi-Brule's observation of the Boro people of Brazil, who said they were red parrots.
Right, which Levi-Brule saw as this illogical, participatory mind, incapable of scientific thought.
But Vygotsky argued the complex theory gives a much simpler psychological explanation. If the word for red parrot is actually a complex, a family name for a group that includes the bird, the family, maybe ceremonial objects.
Then saying, I am a red parrot doesn't mean logical identity.
It just means concrete associative membership in that complex group.
Yeah.
The mechanism is a complex relationship, not mystical participation.
That reframes so much. What was seen as primitive thought is just structured differently, still objective, just not abstractly synthesized yet.
Which leads to phase three, true concept formation, the highest stage. This is achieved when abstract synthesis and the deliberate use of the word as a means of concept formation dominate. The word is no longer just a label. It's the tool used to analyze, generalize, and organize thought systematically.
And that mastery of the word as a systemic tool is the perfect segue into chapter 6, which gives us one of Vygotsky's most profound contributions for education, the distinction between scientific and spontaneous concepts.
This is where he explicitly links what happens in a classroom to psychological development. He distinguished between spontaneous concepts.
The ones from everyday experience.
Right. Derived from non-conscious, unorganized experience. They're rich in content, like understanding what a brother is or the feeling of heavy. And then you have scientific concepts.
Which come from formal instruction.
Exactly. They're abstract and conscious from the start, like mass exploitation or historical materialism.
Now, on the surface, it seems obvious that spontaneous concepts, since they're tied to real experience, should always develop first and be stronger.
You'd think so. But Vygotsky, through his experiments, found a developmental paradox.
What was the evidence?
It was startling. He and his team used tasks where kids had to complete sentence fragments with logical connectors like because or although, and the topics were either from everyday life or from their social science curriculum.
And what did they find?
Counterintuitively, the data showed that the development of scientific concepts often runs significantly ahead of spontaneous concepts in terms of conscious awareness and using those logical connectors.
Can you give us an example from that data?
Certainly. In one set of tests with second graders, the kids scored much higher on completing fragments. When the material was from the systematic curriculum like explaining why a factory needs coal, they scored around 79.7% correct.
Okay.
But when the fragments were about spontaneous, everyday stuff like explaining why a boy fell off his bike, the score dropped to 59.0%.
That's a huge drop. Yeah. Why the struggle with the familiar? If a kid knows why they fell off a bike, why is it harder to articulate that relationship consciously?
The explanation lies in the direction of their development. Spontaneous concepts develop upward. They start as rich, concrete knowledge from action, but they're non-conscious and unsystematic. A child can use the word brother perfectly, but they can't give you a systematic definition of kinship for years. They move from the concrete base up toward abstraction.
And scientific concepts move in the opposite direction, downward.
They start as abstract, conscious structures, what we might call verbalisms. A child learns the definition of mass in physics, maybe detached from real experience at first. But over time, through instruction and application, it grows downward to incorporate rich, concrete experience.
So it's like scientific concepts provide the conceptual skeleton first, and spontaneous concepts provide the muscle and flesh first.
That's a powerful analogy. The key is that instruction provides the necessary system. Scientific concepts get conscious control because they are, from the start, mediated by other concepts in the same system.
It's part of a structure.
It is. Vygotsky compared it to learning a foreign language. You don't learn Spanish words in a vacuum. You use the grammar and semantics of your native language as a foundation. Scientific concepts use the structure of the curriculum to gain that same systemic organization.
This sounds like a complete vindication of the ZPD. The teacher, by providing the scaffolding of the scientific system, lets the child operate with these advanced concepts sooner than they can manage on their own.
Absolutely. Instruction isn't just input. It charts new paths for spontaneous development by making the child aware of their own mental operations. The big conclusion here is Vygotsky's assertion that consciousness is achieved when a concept enters a system of generality.
When you know how A fits into B.
And how B relates to C. That gives you conscious control. The scientific structure forces that organization, enabling deliberate control and awareness. A spontaneous concept learned in an isolation, no matter how rich, remains unsystematic and therefore non-conscious.
Okay, we've moved from the cultural roots to the social structure of concepts. In Chapter 7, Vygotsky takes us inside the ultimate private product of all this, inner speech and its relationship to consciousness.
Inner speech, as the final evolution of egocentric speech, is the mechanism of our silent thought. And Vygotsky showed its structure is fundamentally different from external speech. Its basic syntax is radical predication.
Predication meaning the sentence is compressed, often dropping the subject.
Precisely. If you mentally ask yourself, why is that window open? You don't form the whole sentence. You might just think, open window, why? Or even just open.
It's extremely abbreviated.
It is. And the reason is functional. Since inner speech is purely speech for oneself, the subject, the context, is always known. The speaker is the listener. So why waste energy articulating what's already obvious?
It relies completely on known context. And Vygotsky used the brilliant literary example to illustrate this, the initial letter exchange in Tolstoy's Anna Karenina.
It's the definitive analogy. In the novel, Kitty and Levin communicate this complex emotional sentiment. When you answered, it cannot be. Did you mean then or never? Just using the initial letters of the words.
Which is only possible because they share this intimate, established context.
That context supplies all the missing pieces. And inner speech operates under that same rule, except the shared context is entirely within your own mind. It is maximum sense delivered with minimum external structure.
And that brings us to the semantics of inner speech, the distinction Vygotsky makes between meaning and sense.
We have to separate them. Meaning is the stable dictionary definition, the core of the word, accessible to everyone. But sense is dynamic, fluid, personal. It's the sum of all the psychological events, feelings, and images that a word brings up in our consciousness at a specific moment.
And in inner speech, sense is king.
Sense reigns supreme over meaning. And that leads to the phenomenon Vygotsky called the influx of sense.
The influx of sense, what's that?
It describes how, in inner speech, the senses of different words flow into one another, often collapsing the psychological significance of an entire complex idea into a single, highly charged word.
Can you give an example?
Think about the title of Google's novel, Dead Souls. A literal meaning is just dead serfs on a list. But the sense, once you finish the novel, encompasses tragedy, satire, social critique, the human condition. In our inner speech, we operate with that collapsed, rich sense instantly.
But even this highly abbreviated, sense-driven inner speech is not the same as thought itself. Thought is on another plane.
That's the deepest conclusion. Vygotsky realized thought has its own structure. It's a simultaneous, holistic flow, not a sequence of separate grammatical units like speech.
It's a whole, not parts.
Right. The transition from that holistic thought to the sequential word isn't automatic. Thought has to realize itself in words. This is why sometimes a thought is so complex that it will not enter words, as Dostoevsky said. We think faster and more diffusely than we can speak.
And to understand that final plane of verbal thought, that process of realization, Vygotsky tells us to look at the theater and Stanislavski's concept of the subtext.
Stanislavski, the great director, taught actors that to truly understand an utterance on stage, you have to grasp the motivation behind the words, the subtext. The spoken words in the script are just the external sign of a vast inner psychological flow.
The inner motive.
Yes, and Vygotsky applies this to all human communication. To truly understand what someone is saying, you have to understand not just the word, not just the logical thought, but the underlying motivation that generated that thought in the first place.
That sequence from external speech to inner speech to the motive that generates the thought, that's the full circle of his analysis.
And that leads to his most profound final statement. The word is a microcosm of human consciousness. It directly reflects our historical and social nature. It links consciousness for others, which is social communication, with consciousness for myself, which is inner thought. The word is the living union of generalization and communication, of thought and culture.
Wow. We have covered a tremendous amount of ground in this deep dive into thought and language, going all the way from his methodological critiques to the very nature of inner motive.
We have. And we've seen that Vygotsky fundamentally shifted psychology away from studying isolated mental functions or static biological development. He forced us to see the dynamic, culturally mediated, and systemic connection between the tools of language and the structures of thought.
His work really provided the experimental and theoretical proof that the relationship between thought and word is developmental, it's variable, and it is deeply, profoundly social.
And this social mediation is what transforms our natural mental functions into cultural higher mental functions.
And it's a powerful realization that every single word we speak, every phrase we organize in our mind is just. It's saturated with the history of human cooperation and instruction.
The word isn't just a label. It is the most critical tool we use to organize our very awareness and gain conscious control over our mental life.
You know, it's often said, in the beginning was the word. But Vygotsky, citing Goethe, suggests a crucial modification.
He does. The word wasn't the beginning. Action, or the deed, was there first, driven by immediate needs. But the word is the crowning end of development. It's the ultimate realization of the deed, allowing us to reflect, to generalize, and to plan future action.
So as you, our listener, reflect on this entire deep dive, consider Vygotsky's legacy and this final provocative thought.
If language provides the system and consciousness is achieved when a concept enters a system, how does becoming conscious and deliberate about the language you use, the systems you employ, the generalizations you choose, how does that fundamentally change the very way you think about your own actions and intentions?